Well, welcome back. I'm really glad to see many of you and to see some new faces today, too. I'm Jeff Kersengrip. My name has not changed. I'm still a professor at the University of Portland. I'm a communication social scientist. I study the between of things as primary, not as secondary, not as an artifact of people's thinking or sociology, but the place where everything happens is right here. And so today we're moving on. We looked at what my goal yesterday was to try and get people thinking about checking your privilege to be similar to checking your oil or checking your pantry or checking your bank account, things that you would just do, right, without a whole lot of worry about it or a lot of weight in it, but just to keep yourself aware of where we keep us aware of where we are. Many of the opponents of checking privilege are people who are really privileged themselves and don't want a lot of attention drawn to privilege. So when you're listening to people being, let's say, fragile, that's one of the words that's been attached to people's reluctance to treat checking your privilege like checking your bank account. Many have particular agendas they're trying to preserve, and that in your own circumstances, often you're better off if you are able to do it that way. I meant this just to be a little sidebar, but it's among the things that I'll share with you, if you like, down the road. Today we're going to do three things. One is I want to pose a framing question for you. It's the one that's in the title of this session. And I'm going to outline the blog post, a really interesting little blog post from a woman of color who works in the Christian church and does activist work. And she's drawn some conclusions for herself about why she shifted her focus. And it's a provocative post, so I'm going to just unpack it for you in a PowerPoint for about 10 minutes so you can see what her perspective is. Then we'll watch a film called Cracking the Codes, which takes a systemic view of they're looking mostly, again, at racism, but just thinking about it as not, you know, a bad individual behaving badly, but actually it's a whole system, and they set up a model for you, and then they break it down by chapters, so you really get to see it in a bunch of different permutations, and you get to hear it from first-person voices. That's one of the things the film does really well, is it gets me out of the picture and really lets you hear from people who are directly involved in this work. And then at the end, we'll come back again to that. First of all, two kinds of responses from you. One is just what sorts of things you harvest from the film. And secondly, what's your take on this author's provocative question? We won't discuss it before the film, but we will afterwards. Let's see what thoughts you have about the stance she would love you to take, and let's see what you think of that. Hello.
Hi, Jeff.
Hellos are extra strong when they have a microphone. So here's her post, this Erna Kim Hackett. Her bio is at the very end. But this is her perspective. She says, you know what, I was really excited when racial reconciliation came about in the 1990s, but I've since really soured on it, and now I work on talking about white supremacy. I don't talk about racial reconciliation anymore. So it's a woman of color working in a Christian context with Christian justification. So here's the essence of her argument. She's saying, she often gets pushback from people, not just white people, when she uses the phrase white supremacy rather than white privilege to talk about what her focus is. And she says most people are fine with white supremacy when it's referring to something like we saw in Charlottesville with people, you know, doing Nazi stuff. It's like, that's a pretty low bar. Like there, it's okay. I'm okay with you talking about white supremacy there. That's fine. But in daily life, no, can't be that. And so most of my crowd, she says, was taught to use the terms white privilege and racial reconciliation. And this is her justification for doing something different, right? So in the 90s, she found biblical basis, right, and communal energy toward this notion of racial reconciliation. People were getting excited about this as a possibility when she went along. But the more recent, say, responses to Black Lives Matter activism, which is much more targeted at a systems level of racism, has soured her on that idea and made her really dig into it and think about it more deeply. Especially evangelical organizations themselves, watching white Christians and POC, people of color, as she's abbreviating it, submitted to whiteness. So here she's talking about people who are not themselves white, but who are participating in and even supporting a system of white supremacy, respond again and again and again to things that BLM is really upset about with these kinds of responses, denying there is some kind of systemic injustice, maybe just a bad cop. If we just get rid of the bad cops, you know, people won't be shot for buying groceries. Disregard for the lived experience, the storytelling of black people, their own experiences, their own emotions. Silence from the pulpit about this sort of thing. One of the questions raised yesterday was, do you go to a church that prioritizes white supremacy more than Jesus did? A deeply ingrained superiority regarding issues of race. We're more advanced as white people, so we explain things for people and we understand things for people. And a fixation on intentions over outcomes. Doesn't matter how well we do it, just the fact that we're trying should count for something. I'm good now. Right, I'm woke, be nice to me. So she didn't like these responses, and she thought, why don't I like these responses? Why people discipled by the racial reconciliation framework were so ill-equipped to engage, learn from, and respond to a movement like Black Lives Matter that's focused on systemic and institutionalized racial injustice? How did that fail us so badly at that level and lead us instead to these alternate pieces? By the way, as a preview of Friday's session, which is my next one, we have 2 days in between, that day we are going to look at some of those diversionary tactics that we routinely are part of in conversation and give us some tools for responding to those when they happen and also unpacking them. So when somebody comes to you and says, well, white privilege, am I just supposed to feel guilty? You're going to have a lot of responses for them that you'll smile at, and they'll smile at too. It's like, oh, you're right. That's an easy thing to do. So that's where we're heading on Friday. So she's identifying four little themes here. One is she's saying bad theology. Go ahead.
So would you discuss the meaning of woke? You know, I've just recently started hearing this term, and I'm thinking I probably know what it means. But
how would you identify? Anybody in the room want to take this one on? What does woke mean in the present context? What's a synonym for it? What would it mean to be woke? It's usually how it's referred to.
Suddenly you're not getting
it. It's a good question. A little more empathy, a little more ability to stand in the shoes of people who are not you and to see the injustice that they see daily, to get a little bit of a peek of it. In fact, to get a lot of a peek of it. It's puzzling, though, because you can't really claim it for yourself. You know, yeah, I'm woke. That's a sure way to get laughs from my students. It's to say, I'm your teacher and I'm woke. Ha, 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 sure you are. Yeah. Exactly. How do you know when you're not? Probably as soon as you say you are, you just got a little less woke. So she picks on four things to make her case. All real briefly, it's a four-page post, and I've got it here for you. I've also got a couple for you that you can look at before Friday if you want to. One by Wendell Berry from the book The Hidden Wound, and another more recent essay from Rebecca Solnit. Any of you read her? So she's talking about the politics of disconnection. So she's kind of taking it to a political level and saying, what does it mean when Melania Trump wears a jacket that says something like, I don't really care, do you, when she's visiting a detention facility for kids who've been taken from their families? And that there's something about that that's actually systemic, and Solnit makes some sense of that. So those are things coming for us. So this author is talking about bad theology as one of the places that she identifies taking issue with racial reconciliation. It's a term, first of all, that mainly serves people like me, white people, and those who align with whiteness. So it's relational in nature, and though relationships are important, it's anchored in U.S. white theology's pathological, what she calls individualism. That this is how evangelical churches especially talk about Christian faith. It's about me, right? And scholars of the Bible actually refer to those same kinds of verses as not talking about you as an individual, but you as a community, you as a group. That usually in context, the biblical you is plural, addressed to an entire community of people. So all scripture has been reduced to individual interactions between God and a person in white theology, even when they're actually originally between God and the community or Jesus and a group of people. She sees that as pathological. You can understand why we do that in an individualist culture like the U.S., right? Americans, we're an individualist culture. You get your value from stretching the envelope a little bit, making your own way. To demonstrate this to students, I ask them how many are excited to move back with their parents once they graduate from college. And only the Asian students raise their hands and say, yep, I'm a much better contributor to our family now. I'm going to be able to do a lot more for us. And the students who weren't raised in that environment just go, really? You know, I'd be considered a failure if I went back to the womb. I'm supposed to get out there and create my own life. So we have a society that really, really prioritizes this. So it's not surprising that we would take scripture and also make it to say that in this circumstance. And she's identifying a particular harm associated with that. So, of course, how do we make sense of racism then? If we're making it all about individualism, we're saying it's hateful thoughts and deeds by an individual. But we can't comprehend a more communal or institutionalized sin, because we don't talk about scripture in that way. We don't use the Bible in that way. She sees that as a real problem. Here's the second of two critiques she has of theology. I like Disney princess theology. As each individual reads scripture, we see ourselves as the princess in every story. We're Esther, never Xerxes or Haman. We're Peter, but never Judas. We're the woman anointing Jesus, never the Pharisees. We're the Jews escaping slavery, never Egypt. But think about it. To see ourselves as Israel and not Egypt, you know, we're Egypt. We look a lot like Egypt. So here's where she comes back to. She says, because of these two kind of aspects of theology and how it's taught to us, when we're in power, we don't really have a lens for locating ourselves rightly in scripture or in society, and it's made us blind and not very well equipped to engage issues of power and injustice at a systems level. I feel like I'm using my Mr. Rogers voice here. Is that going to put anybody to sleep? I could be more animated. All right. So this, in her mind, explains why we love a photo of a cop at a protest hugging a little black kid at the protest. Remember that viral photo? It was from Portland, actually. A Portland cop, and actually a really good cop, I know about this particular guy. And I think that little guy has since died, actually,
He hasn't been found, but yes.
Yeah? It's too bad. But we dismiss claims of systemic racism in policing. You might have heard another version of this when the Thai boys were trapped in the cave recently, and all the worldwide concern for those particular boys in that particular place, but some of the same, you know, a much broader circumstance that's affecting millions of people doesn't get our attention. We like the particular. We like the individual. And it confuses white emotional catharsis with racial justice. If I, to use the word you brought up a minute ago, if I become woke and have an emotional, you know, connective experience with another person, our culture unduly prioritizes that and says, great, you're there. That's it. Okay, now you're dealing appropriately with your sense of privilege. You're ready to meet each new encounter in a good way. Problem solved. And she's recognizing that that's not the way to go. One of the other legs that she's criticizing as weak is bad history. She's saying to maintain all this, we need an innocent reading of history, her argument is. So to have unjust and racist systems, we have to be blameless. But if you look back, what are we reconciling? When have we ever been in just relationship, we white people, ever been in just relationship with black people? Was it during slavery or Jim Crow or stop and frisk? Or border separations of brown families? You know, what are we trying to get back to? Have we ever been there? So she doesn't even like the metaphor of reconciliation. What are we reconciling? We're not, especially. Was there a time when everything was fine? We just need to get back there. Didn't exist. So bad history. Even when we teach the civil rights movement, often what's taught about it is how heroic they were, right? Courage of black people, which is true. But why did they have to be so courageous? What were they facing? The rage, racism, and violence of white people. I didn't learn about this, especially in college and high school. What I did learn was this, minimized to a few racist exceptions in the South. What do they always show us? What photos do you remember from your education?
The hosing.
Okay, fire hosing.
Yeah.
Any others?
Police dogs.
Pardon?
Police dogs.
Police dogs. Pulling people off lunch counters. Shouting, just screaming at African-American kids who are heading for schools, integrating schools, watching just the stoic African-American kids going about their business with people just like this. So that's actually a move to preserve whiteness, is to say, oh yeah, we've had some racism, it was down there. It was those things and it was long ago. Okay. But it wasn't just in the South. All over the U.S., people resisted, let's say, changes to real estate laws that would have made it easier for African-Americans to get home loans. For example, or to buy in areas that would appreciate rather than depreciate in value, build wealth. The most recent number I've seen is the average American family, the average white American family has 14 times the wealth of the average African American family. 14 times the wealth. In 2011, it was 11 times the wealth. So it's gotten worse. And most of our wealth is tied up in real estate. So lots of things have been happening institutionally that really, it feels like, you know, the table keeps slipping in ways that are very clever. But our history doesn't tell us the true story of whiteness. I didn't learn about that stuff until I was in graduate school. Jim, yes?
So I've noticed that we're talking about racism and stuff, people of color, but what I've noticed is you're centering on black people.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a reason for that?
Well, because they tend to bear the brunt. I mean, we hardly ever talk about Asian Americans who also experience racism in the culture. But in many ways, Asian American people outperform white people. In a lot of different ways. So it's to include everybody who's not white, that's appropriate for some conversations. For this one, focusing on African-American folks is a really nice way to center what's going on because they often experience it the worst. A lot of the stats are just to show that disparity. I don't even know the disparity between, say, Hispanic Americans and white Americans in income.
Because in the metro area of Minnesota, mm-hmm. one of the highest populations of Somali Americans, a lot of Latin Americans.
Mm-hmm.
They do very well.
Some do.
And so I just noticed you just kind of sent me on that.
Right.
I
don't know. I think a lot of times the people who do this work center on that community because that's the place where the stats can be presented most starkly. Those realities are true also for other groups in other ways, but that's one of the places it shows up. In the same way that you can still lose the game when it's on its easiest setting, right? You also can win the game when it's rigged against you. There are things you can do that make you be, you know, I'm really well off as a Somali American in Minneapolis, St. Paul. I'm doing great. In that regard. By the way, one of the really interesting things among my students at UP is the students who are African, very recently here from Africa, really hate being seen as African-American. They pick up on it really quickly and say, no, I'm African, I'm not African-American. And when does that change? Like after how many generations in St. Paul would you start to say, well, now I guess I'm an African-American? I had an African-American student who was from South Africa recently, and he was white. Have you had an African-American student who's white before? I mean, entirely. It was Afrikaans. That's a good question. I had that question myself. I wondered. It is a big deal in our culture to know where you are racially, to know where you stand. The film will be interesting to you in this regard. One more. Fair enough. Sure. That doesn't cancel it out. Yeah. I think Solnit in her essay makes the point that every Western we saw, the Indians are always coming from outside the frame to the white people at the center. They're always the interlopers, even though they were here first, you know. We took them over. So we've done a lot of things to frame a lot of different groups as outsiders and ourselves at the center. We do that a lot. So the consequence for us in the modern day, according to this particular author, is that we don't believe it when white racism is pointed out in the present. I've been told a fairy tale about myself. White violence is generally erased in the histories that we've been told. And the consequences of those injustices today are minimized, they're downplayed. And instead we attribute it to individual people like, what's wrong with you, Jeremy? You know, why can't you create better circumstances for yourself? Something about individuals is clearly at fault, and that helps too. Here's her third leg. In the racial reconciliation model, people of color are commodities. They're also spectacles. We think of people of color as primarily there to teach us and educate us about whiteness, right? When I'm ready to learn, it's sort of an obligation that you're supposed to share your story, that your pain is for my consumption. That's your role. If you want a better society, well then come on, help me out. You're my friend. That's exhausting. So whiteness often listens, feels superior to other white people who aren't as woke, there's that word again, but does not change, right? The system, in fact, doesn't change. This is her critique. I'm using all her words here. I'm not even defending them. I'm just putting them out there for you to see what you think after you see the film. It focuses on making sure people like me don't feel guilty, but not on the systemic disenfranchisement of other groups. And here's some of the ways that shows up for us. What it prioritizes is what's there in yellow. We love the stories of people who've come around, individuals who are now doing great things for their communities who were jerks before. The hardest one is number 3, I think. So, I mean, I like to be a person. In all my interactions, I like to be treated as exactly the human I am. And yet we set up a system where if a person of color is in a room with a bunch of people who look like many of us, they feel a little bit obliged to kind of take on that mantle and to be called on in that regard. It's like, oh my God, what a weight. There's even a word for it. It's called stereotype threat. Have you heard about this phenomenon? Mm-hmm. It's a really good, Claude Steele is the psychologist that came up with it. There's an unconscious weight that affects my performance when I feel like I'm representing a group. Happens to white guys when we take math tests in a room with Asian guys and somebody reminds us that we're not supposed to do as well as the Asian guys and then we don't.
Oh. Right?
But the effect goes away if somebody says, oh, by the way, this test has never had that effect. And then suddenly our scores are right where they should be. It's an amazing little effect. So it happens to anytime you feel like you're representing a group in a testing situation and you care about how you do, it's an effect that can get you. So you get objectified and you do it to yourself as well. So here's the role. If I'm a person of color in racial reconciliation, according to this author, my role is to be grateful that you want to have this conversation, to stay loyal to you, because now you're in the conversation, oh, now you're my special friend, and to educate, but nicely and without anger, right? And conform to white culture. These are all the expectations of people who are people of color in these circumstances. You should trust your leaders, be satisfied with good intentions, even if it doesn't quite work out. Oh, that was a good conversation, wasn't it, 10 years ago? To be participating in the system, you don't have to be white. That's one of the canards that people will come at you with and say, but, you know, that was a Hispanic American man who was canvassing at the door for, you know, this candidate or whatever. So none of this can be right. No, you can participate in the system. So a couple last points. The fourth one she's picking on is the term white privilege itself. She's saying it can be helpful, but it's still located in the individualism that she calls pathological. It's not helpful to think about it. It assumes that issues are resolved by how an individual handles their privilege. So she says, this can't be the term that's sufficient to address or resolve these kinds of responses. Maybe your church is trying to respond, right? Then you're not thinking about privilege as much as you're thinking about supremacy. You can't dismantle those cultural systems with something when you're thinking about it like just privilege. However, she says it is useful, it is real, it's often a first step, but it's not enough for anyone, especially anyone in leadership. We need something else. So here's where she goes. Shifting to the term white supremacy is a move away from pathological individualism. It puts responsibility on white people to stop supporting white supremacy versus putting the responsibility on people of color to educate and provide diversity. One example that helps my students get this is I ask them if they've ever heard the phrase, I don't mind gay relationships, gay male relationships, I just don't want them to push it down my throat. And what they're implicitly saying there is, I want those guys to fix it for me. My feeling about them, that's their problem. You know, so keep that stuff private. Really? Keep that stuff private? You can't hold hands with, you know, your husband? That's odd. So we just have a built-in expectation, as Ta-Nehisi Coates was saying yesterday, that we expect things to be accommodated for us. I'm uncomfortable. Please make me more comfortable. I'm being polite for now. You know, it's on you. And she's saying, that's not really how it should go. I should just sort of laugh at that and say, well, I hope you solve that problem you're having with, you know, seeing the two of us being affectionate with the people we love in our lives. So here's the essence of her argument. Racial reconciliation often views people of color as the problem that needs to be solved. Okay, because it's so preoccupied with good intentions of whiteness and its allies, it considers the deaths and departures of people of color sad, but no reflection on those of us participating in the system. It locates the problem in the right place. White supremacy does, in a way that racial reconciliation does not, according to her. Here's her final point. Labels the problem more accurately. What are we up against? Are we up against the problem of reconciliation or a problem of supremacy? That's the nut. Ready for a movie? All right, we'll come back to this. And again, if you'd like the full version of this, I'll just pass around the packet if you want one. This is her original post. I just took bits and pieces of it. It's not very long. A couple more for you to take before you're done today. I'd ask you to do one thing for me here as you're watching the film. Remember this?
Yes.
Love this cartoon. I've remembered this one forever. What we say to dogs... Okay, Ginger, I've had it. You stay out of the garbage. Understand, Ginger? Stay out of the garbage. Or else what they hear, blah, blah, Ginger, blah, 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 Ginger. So I'd like you to, for yourself, as you're watching the film, pay attention to your Ginger moments versus your blah, 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 blah moments. So when you're watching the film, some of it will go past you, but some of it's going to go, Ginger, and you're going to think, oh, I want that one. Okay, things that resonate with you. It's another way to think about that bit. And again, as we finish the film, I want to hear from you about what sorts of Ginger moments you took from the film there.
The system of inequity is embedded in history, culture, and identity. It has internal components and external components. These components are
Thank you, Sarah.
Or influenced by power and economics. The internal component consists of bias, privilege, and internalized racism. The external components play out in relationships which are interpersonal, institutional, and structural. All of these layers are happening simultaneously, and they are churning out inequity. In the Western world, we worship the disguised sun. All else can remain silent. That's the supernatural, the spiritual, and unexplained oddities. We need facts. That which you can see and grasp. Fact. Europe is not and has never been a continent. Yet they teach us cities all through school. So when I raise my hand in class and ask, hey, teach, continent defined as a large landmass completely or almost completely surrounded by water. Europe is neither large nor even almost surrounded by water. How is it a continent? I get looked at like a fool. Teach tells me, because it is. Now, this never flew with me as a kid. I didn't get the answer needed. I'm disrupting the rest of your class period. So now I'm in the principal's office being asked to explain why I'm questioning the continent's validity. And I find myself saying, this country is hypocrisy from top to bottom. You raised me to focus on facts. I know what you asked. Now you let me know I'm digging too deep.
Oh, oh, my.
Puerto Rico, in many ways, is very homogeneous in the way that it is perceived. We have taken on an essential identity where we're all Latinos or we're all Puerto Ricans. Then we forget a history of slavery. We forget a history of white Spaniard domination. We forget a history of Arawak genocide and how that creates the Latino. And so often we think about the Puerto Rican or the Latino without thinking about the historical and colonial legacies that have over time constructed who we are today.
My mother explained slavery to me. And I remember I was really, you know, like in elementary school, and she described slavery, that people, human beings were slaves. And I didn't understand what she meant, so I asked her to explain that. What do you mean? They had them to do a lot of chores, because she had us doing a lot of chores at home. But I knew that wasn't what she meant, but I wanted to, what do I compare this to? She said, oh, no sugar, uh-uh. They couldn't be married, they couldn't keep their children, they didn't have their own souls, everything was taken from them, and you know, your grandfather, she meant her father, his father was a slave. I said, no way. I said, well, why did the people let themselves be slaves? And she said, oh, Erica, it wasn't like that. The whole government supported it. And then I got really sad. So sad, I don't think I could cry about it. I just couldn't fathom grown-ups as I thought of them being that mean. Just mean. I didn't have a name for it, just mean.
Hawaii was conquered by white people. The queen was dethroned. Hawaiian people were put on plantations to work alongside Japanese people and Filipino and Chinese people. Many Hawaiians were converted to Christianity. There's a kind of assimilation that tries to happen. The Hawaiian monarchy wearing English clothes and, you know, the collars, the dresses with the high collars, the very Victorian, you know, English kinds of clothes. And people kind of glorifying that royalty, but yet they're living in shacks. And I'm not talking about grass shacks, I'm talking about squalor shacks, slums.
No one had ever told me in school. No one had ever told me the truth. They told me about Crispus Attucks. Okay, and you know I don't have anything against Crispus Attucks, but I needed to know more than the black men who fought in the American Revolution, you know? But I didn't get the truth. I was told a watered-down story about Native Americans, and I watched TV shows that showed Native peoples as savages that didn't speak any language that was discernible. African people that had bones through their noses and had no language except booga booga. When I realized that this is what not only I was taught, but all of the nation's children and people were being taught this, I'm so pissed off.
I think there's a misconception that's out there in mainstream society that sees our people as primitive and uncivilized. There was a high level of organized society that existed around us, to the point where I would say that as colonizers came to our land, as the settlers came, they mimicked and followed some of those ways of looking at the way that we did our governance. But I like to start before that to talk about the strength and the way of life that we had. And sometimes it's difficult to talk fully about who we are because over the years we've lost a lot. I had to learn U.S. history in a new way. Learning about the Marshall Islands in particular, the history of U.S. bomb testing on the Marshall Islands.
A device with 1,000 times the energy of the bomb that shattered Hiroshima, exceeding the power of that bomb as vastly as it exceeded the greatest high-explosive giants of World War II.
There's a one long skinny island where the U.S. military base is, and then there's this other island called Abai, where all of the folks of color live, and they come over during the day and work in a lot of the service sector jobs, and then go back at the end of the day, and also have radiation from all of the bomb testing that happened, in the mid-20th century. That was something I had no idea about.
How many of our stories are left untold? Buried under piles of dust waiting to be forgotten? Can we truly forget them? Or did they just get told in other ways? Humankind, but the human mind is a master at building barriers. Fact, the human psyche will do almost anything to remove dissonance. Dissonance means that which is outside of your comfort zone.
When I was really young, probably up until the age of about 8 or 9, the social network, the relationships, the family, friends were all mostly people of South Asian descent. I wasn't so aware of myself as a racial being. And then something shifted. And at that point, I started rejecting my own culture, community, quite drastically. And although there were so many people of color that were around me, I really wanted to be accepted and assimilate with white people.
I was taught that life that's worth noticing and living is just a little wedge of the 360 degrees. Now, they didn't say it in so many words, but I was taught there are these lines that mark off the rest of the world and the rest of the world's people from what is good. And in my coming up as a child, again and again, I heard phrases like good families, good neighborhoods, good books, good music, good taste, good manners, good jobs, good investments. Those goods demarcated what I was meant to respect and beyond which I was not meant to stir.
She's the one who invented.
College I went to was really white and really suburban. And so I had to find like a small sector of people I could hang out with, but most of those people were white.
I remember, I'll never forget this, I saw an Indian person on TV, which back then was like unheard of. And I'd be like, oh my God, there's an Indian person on TV. And they'd be like, well, why is that such a big deal to you? And I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm Indian.
I remember when I didn't know I was black. My mother is black and white. My grandmother is an Irish woman born on a farm. My mother had very, very, very light white skin, freckles, and brown hair that falls straight. So here she is, a black girl growing up without the absolute black exterior in a black experience in a black family, where she's too light and white to be cool with black children, and too light black folks to be cool with white children. My father is black and from Tennessee. And my mother, I think because though she was black, didn't have, you know, my sisters are brown skinned, nappy headed girls, you know. She couldn't fully understand what that meant for us. My mother would tell us things like, you know, yeah, you're black and you're white, but more than anything, you're a good person. We have several different cultures in us and in our background. Da, 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 da. And it, I don't think she was deliberately dodging the issue of race, but I think she couldn't fully understand the impact of, you know, no police officer ever pulled me over and considered my racial mixture.
When I was a couple of days old, I was adopted. My birth parents are black Colombians, and my adoptive family was Caucasian. In my parents' mind, I'm their child, and they're white. And what does that make me? And my adoptive father has talked about what it was like for him to have my birth father, a black man, come to stay with them in their house and come to church with us. And for my adoptive dad to stand up and introduce who my birth father was, and he said, really, it was in that space when he really realized that everyone else in the church was looking at my birth dad and now suddenly at me as a black person. And that was never something he'd had to confront before. And suddenly he realized that that was something that I, as an adult, was connected to as well.
For me as a Latino, I can choose to be one of multiple identities. So if I moved to Michigan without talking, I could pass for Arab. If I moved to California, I could pass for Mexican. If I moved to Florida, I could be Cuban and Puerto Rican. If I'm in New York, I could be Dominican, Puerto Rican, or anything as long as I'm not downtown. That's where all the white folk coming out.
I had a girlfriend who was raised in a black family on the south side of Chicago, and she was the only mixed race person in her family. She ended up living in France for 6 years with her sister, who ended up settling in France. And over there, people there thought she was Moroccan because there's a large Moroccan and Algerian population. And so therefore, in that environment, she was treated the way North African women in France are treated. And she began to really identify with those relationships, and her primary source of support and relationship ended up being Moroccan and Algerian women. She started to really identify with that. And then when she came back to the United States, she had this experience where she, you know, black folks didn't totally accept her. Or they did, but they didn't really understand the whole thing in France that she'd experienced. And then white folks treated her like she was black. And so she was moving between different racial dynamics in different social contexts. And somehow I was able to relate to her. And what it's helped me realize is that identity is complex. How we navigate and negotiate it is complex, and therefore, I think we have to come up with solutions to how we navigate the complexity of our identities that are more flexible than the rigidness of racism and race.
What is whiteness?
Growing up, I thought that my experience was the American experience, and that everybody in the whole United States had lived exactly as I did, and that's an experience where everybody looked exactly like me. So I was born in Medford, Oregon, and in Medford there were absolutely no people of color. within the city limits. And then I met another woman, when she was a girl, so we're 11 years old, and I meet another person who then becomes my best friend. She still is my best friend. And her name was Serena Maria Cruz, right? So Serena, for me, wasn't of color. She was white. So we're graduating, we're setting up for the PSAT to take the test, and this is where we've gone to school together for 5 or 6 years, and we've been to each other's houses, we've had birthday parties, we're all involved in the same gifted program activities, and she's filling out her form and filling out her race, and I'm filling out my form, and I look over at Serena, and I see her filling out the bubble for Hispanic. And so I actually reach out and I grab her hand and I pull it up and I tell her, Serena, you're supposed to fill out the white bubble. And she looks at me and she says, look at me, Susie. She says, look at me, like this. And I looked at her and I didn't have any clue what she was talking about. I didn't know what she was talking about.
I think unconscious bias is really heavily implicated in white America's racial attitudes in this age of Obama, so to speak. On the one hand, I think a lot of white folks who actually admire President Obama a lot, who voted for him, who find him to be an extremely erudite, intelligent, capable leader. Nonetheless, and we know this from the studies, many of those folks will indeed have implicit associations between black folks and negativity, different stereotypes, different views, and they've taken, many of them, the implicit association tests that have been run by Harvard and Princeton and others, that can test for these sort of subconscious biases. And what those studies have found is 75% of white Americans have overtly pro-white, anti-black bias. Well, by definition, some of those folks voted for Barack Obama because he got about, 44% of the white vote, 45%. So by definition, a large number of white folks who carry around this sort of baggage of bias and prejudice toward, let's say, the black community, are willing to carve out these exceptions for those who make us comfortable, who seem different from the norm.
My ex-husband is a white man, and he adores and always has adored his son. There were things that happened to my son in the communities that he lived in because he was mixed race that forced him to learn to use both intellect and humor. However, I became aware that as Noah grew older and would defend himself, his father would try to get him to defend himself with anything but his fists, even when he was under attack. And his dad was like, oh, no, we don't want him to be a bully. We don't want him to stoop to their level. I'm going to go and talk to the parents. Well, later we sat down, he and I had a conversation. It's like, well, Noah's being hit. Why shouldn't he defend himself? He's tried every other methodology that we could think of and it hasn't worked. And so I think he has a right to defend himself. What came out of that conversation was outside of my husband's awareness because he loves me and he loves his son. So he had a fear of angry black men. He didn't want his son to be one of those angry black men. And he was doing everything that he could to keep that from happening, even though it meant that Noah was actually being oppressed and abused and stigmatized at school. We finally got to some of those early messages about black boys that still run like wildfire through our educational systems, but it had also impacted my husband, and he wasn't aware of them anymore.
I have internalized messages that support what it means to be white for me. And part of those messages are, I have advice, right? I have knowledge that is good knowledge that everybody deserves to have in order to become like me. So I can give advice, and people will value my advice. And in particular, I can give advice to people of color.
Recently, I was in a meeting with a white woman and an African-American woman, where the African-American woman was trying to explain to the white woman, with me as a witness, that what the white woman was doing was very oppressive to her. The African-American woman took great pains to be respectful, to be as articulate as she could while being kind at the same time, and really told a lot of stories in the hopes that this white woman would understand in what way she was oppressing her. And each time that the African-American woman would tell her story, the white woman would say, "No, you were wrong. No, you must not understand what I was telling you. You obviously don't know me very well. I would never do that. I call this behavior of always being right, always thinking that you know better than a person of color, always trying to make sure that things work for you, as internalized white superiority. I rarely really understand when I'm exhibiting behavior that is racist and internalized white superior in its nature."
When well-meaning white people who've never thought about privilege systems or whiteness or race start out, the teaching is very necessary to get them past blame, shame, and guilt. They were born into circumstances they didn't invent. They were born into history they didn't invent. Rather than have them do the solipsistic thing of getting all self-involved in this, it's just very important to hold them while they get into a rational frame of mind that their big systems existed, they didn't know about, they were born into them. The American myth of meritocracy doesn't apply. We were not taught history, but this is history they're learning. And the American myth of meritocracy is the unit of society is the individual. And whatever you end up with must be what you wanted and worked for and earned and deserved individually. They've been taught that. It's not true. It's partway true. Your individual effort from your own sacred center does matter. But it's untrue also. Huge systems that one's born into will bear on what one can do with one's life and how one will see. And that's the part that has been missing from that education. So these white women breaking up over their first experience of hearing about racism, they are basket cases, partly because of their bad education, their inability to see systemically. And it's not their fault. But they need to be hustled past it as quickly as possible with some remedial words, which I think I've just spoken here. You did not invent the systems you were born into. They are there, and you were taught not to see them, and you were a very good student of what you've been taught.
In a way, my entire career I owe to white privilege, and I tell that story not sort of as a matter of self-flagellation or out of guilt. I tell it because I want people to understand that there can be two things that are true at once. On the one hand, we can work really hard, but on the other hand, our hard work can be met by access to an opportunity structure. So it's not that I didn't work hard. It's not that my great-grandfather, who came here from Russia in, you know, the early part of the 1900s, a Jewish immigrant who didn't speak English, he worked 18 hours a day. It's not that he didn't work hard, but he also had access to jobs that were off limits to people of color the day he got off the boat.
It's a lot easier to recognize how you're different and the doors that close in your face than it is to recognize how you're normal and doors are open for you so that you can step through them. This is not a reality that is only held by white people. In those areas where I am dominant, I just assume that the doors that are held open for me are held open for me because I'm such a fabulous human being. It doesn't dawn on me that I can have a conversation about my dark complexion, and I can have a conversation about being black, and I can have a conversation about being a woman. So I don't have to deal with the fact that because I'm educated, and I speak standard English, and I live a middle-class existence, there are entitlements that I have that other people don't. There are entitlements that I have because I'm heterosexual that some people don't. There are entitlements that I have because I'm US born that some people don't. and I don't have to think about them. And unless I take the blinders off and start looking at the interconnected nature of power and abusive power in particular, I can't have this conversation. And so in the context of race, it shouldn't surprise us that white people have a very difficult time having this conversation because they are not aware of the ways in which they've been socialized and acculturated to take their dominance for granted, even when they're being, they think, politically aware, politically astute, and moving a social justice agenda. There's a way in which whiteness and the normalcy of that whiteness and the superiority of that whiteness shows up that people are completely unaware of.
That was a nice definition of wolf she just gave.
My sister-in-law, who's half black, half white, but looks white, blue eyes, whiter than most white girls, very white. She and I, you know, we kind of grew up together, we raised our children together, so they're first cousins, and we, you know, it's a wonderful, very, very multicultural family. So we're going in a safe way, the white day. And Kathleen, my sister-in-law, is in front of me. And she's, writing a check for her groceries. Now, my daughter, who at the time was 10 years old, was standing with me, and I was directly behind her, you know, getting ready to get my groceries. So Kathleen comes up, and the checker, who is a strawberry blonde, freckled, very delightful, warm, the checker, this young woman, talking to Kathleen, hey, how you doing? It's been a nice day today. They're just chatting up. And says, yeah, so Kathy writes her check, and she steps off to the side with the groceries because she's waiting for me. Of course, again, Kathleen looks white, right? So I come up. No conversation. She looks up at me. Absolutely no, just a little chatter. And I write my check. My daughter, however, is 10, notices immediately the difference in how she responds to me. So I write my check. And she goes, I'm going to need two pieces of ID. At which point, my daughter looks at me, and she gets very, very embarrassed, and tears are kind of coming from her eye, like, Mommy, you're not gonna let her do this. Why is she doing this to us, right? So I'm trying to figure out what I should do, because behind me are two elderly white women. Right? And I'm thinking, okay, so then I become the angry black woman, right? And they're going to be. And I'm just trying to second guess all the drama. Uh-huh. So then I just give her the two pieces of ID. I said, you know, some things you gotta choose your battles, right? And then it gets worse. She pulls out the bad check book, right? So this is the book that shows the people who have written bad checks. So she starts searching for my license in the bad checks, at which point it's just out of control now. Just as I'm standing there, trying to decide what to do, and it's really deeply humiliating. Now my daughter is full-blown emotionally upset, who's 10. My sister-in-law walks back over, and she steps in and she says, excuse me, why are you doing this? And the checker goes, well, what do you mean? She goes, why are you taking her through all of these changes? Why are you doing that? She goes, well, this is our policy. She goes, no, it's not your policy because you didn't do that with me. Oh, well, I know you've been, she goes, no, she's been here for years. I've only lived here for 3 months. And so at this point, the two white elderly ladies go, oh, I can't believe what this checker has done with this woman. It's totally unacceptable. At which point, the manager walks over. The manager walks over and says, is there a problem here? And then my sister-in-law again responds. She goes, yes, there is a problem here. Here's what happened. So you see, she used her white privilege, and even though Kathleen is half black and half white, she recognizes what that means. And she made the statement. She pointed out the injustice. And she, as a result of that one act, influenced everyone in that space. But what would have happened? I can't know for certain had the black woman said, this is unfair. Why are you doing this to me? Would it have had the same impact? But Kathleen knew that she walked through the world differently than I did. And she used her white privilege to educate and make right a situation that was wrong. That's what you can do every single day.
Well, within the black family, within the black community, there are legacies of color. And most people felt that if you were lighter skinned, you would be more acceptable and accepted to the wider culture. But within the black community, many times, people with lighter skin were rejected. My mother felt that. She was rejected by my father's family. And so there was this, it's a lot of different layers of the skin thing. Because within the white community, if you were lighter skinned, you were more acceptable. But within the black community, if you were lighter skinned, many times you were rejected.
My assumptions were that light-complected women had it much easier in the world than darker-complected women. They were the women who were considered beautiful. They were the women that people made a way for. They were the people that looked more like white people than I looked like white people, so white people were more comfortable with them. So life flowed in an easier fashion for them. Until I actually got to know somebody who was really, really, really light-complected. And she laid out a reality that just broke my heart. She desperately wanted to be the color that I was. And basically what that taught me in terms of internalized depression and internalized colorism is how carefully we have been trained culturally to be dissatisfied with our reality as people of color, or actually white folk as well. That the dissatisfaction is bred into the culture and it is part of the ways in which we are oppressed. And the ways in which we oppress others.
I think one of the biggest disturbances that I have about my dad in particular has to do with his upset about how dark he is. I remember about 10 years ago, and I'm 54, so this wasn't that long ago. 10 years ago, he was visiting, and he showed me a picture of himself when he was 4 years old. I had never seen pictures of him when he was young before. He never showed any photos of himself to us. And he showed me this picture. He was 4 years old. He showed me this picture and he says, look at this. I look at the picture and it's this cute, beautiful 4-year-old boy, dark, dark, dark. And then they lived in the desert. They're even darker, right? So they lived out there in the desert. Dark picture of this 4-year-old, cute 4-year-old, and I said, Dad, oh, you're so cute. How come you haven't shown me these pictures before? This is the first time I've seen them. And he said, well, look at it. And I looked at it, and he says, I look like a goddamn piece of charcoal.
Well, I remember a time when I was 6, and I was hanging out at my great-grandmother's home. And she's very white, very Spaniard in her appearance. And I was hanging out with another kid who was my age, a classmate, who was black. And when we went to the house, I was so eager for him to try the strawberry and chocolate grits. You know, in Spanish it's farina or avena, but in English, you know, it's the grits. And I remember my great-grandmother telling me that he couldn't come into the house, but I didn't know why. And I really didn't understand why until later after I became more conscious and reflecting back why it was. And it was very simply because he was black and she didn't want her house, her floor, her presence tinted by blackness.
I'm thinking of myself at age 14, you know, hanging out in the flower shop. There's a white woman and a Latino woman at the counter. The Latino woman was there first. And I choose to talk to the white woman. And then you lose your own humanity, you know, because, you know, what's the humanity in, like, treating someone more poorly than another person?
Very early on, I noticed that there was one other African-American boy in the school and in my class. Rosilius was treated just like I was. That is, that none of the other boys and girls who were white would have anything to do with him or with me. And so I remember there was one particular day when he was just trying to make friends. I don't really remember what it was, but I think it might have been in the classroom during an art project. And he said, you know, why don't you come on over? Why don't you work on this with me? And I said, no, I'm not going to. No, I'm not going to. And I walked away. He actually followed me in the room and started to break out in tears because he knew and I knew what I was doing. But deep down inside at that point, it was real clear to me that he was somebody that I needed to avoid.
I know that I get challenged more in the classroom than my white colleagues. In fact, I actually taught a class with a white colleague. So it was right there. We had the same set of students. We were in the class at the same time. And I saw it day after day that he would say something and had to give very little explanation that followed, and they would all be fine with it. And before I would, you know, say, well, this is your assignment, I have to make sure that I had everything ready for, why are you asking us to do this? Being challenged on every level, with grades, with assignments. So from the point of view of internalized racism, I fall into the trap where I'm justifying and I'm bending over backwards, and I have to remind myself that I'm here because I have an expertise, I have the experience. That's why I'm the instructor. I have to go there, because the automatic reaction is to please, to help them along. That's the internalized racism, is not feeling that I'm capable, but I am capable.
When we look at American chattel slavery, which lasted for centuries, we're always told, don't talk about it, shut it down, why, it's over with now. And what I understand as a healer, as a clinician, you know, and as an educator, is that it doesn't just go away. So the question becomes, what does it look like now? How did it get passed along? What are some of the symptoms of this thing I'm talking about, which I call post-traumatic slave syndrome? But it becomes adaptive behavior, things that lie just beneath the surface. For example, I give this example because it's such a good one. I think people can kind of grasp it. There are certain things like sayings and things you grow up with that you just take for granted. Mama said it, or Big Daddy said it, or Pookie, somebody said it, and it's just something you've come to know. I'll give you an example of that. Let's say that there are two people, 2010, or in contemporary society, that their mother, two mothers, white mother, black mother, or it could be a white mother, a black father, white father, it doesn't matter, it's not gender specific. But you have these two individuals, they have children. Say these two mothers have two sons. And these two sons play together. They go to school together. They spend the night at each other's house. They're best of friends. And they find themselves, the mothers and the two sons, at a school meeting. The black mother and her son are seated next to the white mother and her son. So the black mother leans over and says to the white mother, you know, your son's really doing well. He's really coming along. And she goes, well, thank you. And she begins to say, well, did you know he's in the talented and gifted? And did you know he won the science fair? And did you know his uncle was an astronaut? Because she's oozing with pride. Wonderful. So then the white mother stops for a moment and realizes that the black mother's son is actually excelling her son. So she leans over to the black mother and she goes, what are you talking about? My son, now your son's the one that's really coming along. And the black mother's response is, girl, get out of here. You should have seen that boy yesterday. That boy's a man. Ooh, he's a handful. Stop it. Now, the white mother's response is, wow, they're so negative. No wonder. Why are they so negative? Now, within our cultural adaptation and norm, if you're African American, not even just African, you can be from the Caribbean, black folks know that even though that mother's going, girl, get out of town, he's a mess, she's really proud. Everyone knows that, sort of, except maybe her son. So now let's take a look at this from a different context, because that's not healthy behavior, okay? And whether it's cultural or adaptive, doesn't matter, it's not healthy behavior. Why isn't she praising him? Why isn't she oozing like the white mother? Well, let's roll it back a couple centuries. And now you have a black mother that is seated maybe at the table cutting up onions, or she's working in the fields, and she's enslaved, and her children are with her. And a white slave owner comes over, could be white woman or white man, and they say to that mother, my, now that boy there, he's sure coming along. What is she gonna say? She's gonna say, no, sir. He's shiftless, he can't work, he's stupid, because I don't want you to sell my boy. If it's my daughter, I don't want you to breed her. So I denigrate them to protect them. That is called appropriate adaptation to living in a hostile environment. We never unlearned it. That's post-traumatic slave syndrome. And while we continue to move on and we continue to even excel despite it all, there are some broken parts that we need to fix, and we can't fix it if we don't look.
Can you point to, in your own mind, some of the ways that you are oppressed and oppressing?
I remember when I really was on this, making this journey and really making a commitment that I wanted to heal from the disease I had termed racism. When you make a commitment like that, nature has a way of providing you with all kinds of opportunities to really show that you really are doing the work. So one day after work, I picked up my daughter and we were on our way home. She said, let's go have Chinese food. So it was a Chinese restaurant right up the street from where we lived. So she and I went into the restaurant, waitresses was passing by us, but nobody was really stopping. And then I called one of them, I said, I'd like to get an order to go. And she said, one moment. So she left and she never came back. So I was sitting there, 10 minutes had passed, and I said, wait a minute. So finally, an elderly woman was at the counter, so I said, let me go up and talk to her. So I walked up to her, and I was just reading some stuff off, and she wasn't writing anything down. And so I finished my order, and then she looked at me, and she said, we don't serve you people. And I looked at this woman. I said, look, you know, it's okay. So you don't have to serve me. I said, but I really want you to think about what you're doing. I said, there are all kinds of people in the world. I said, there are good black people and bad black people, good Chinese people and bad Chinese people, good white people and bad. And I, it was like I was having an out-of-body experience. I was looking deep into her eyes and she was, it was like I had captured her and she was listening and I was sharing with her. I said, but I just want you to think about the message that you're sending the young people by saying you don't serve you people. Who are you people?
When 9/11 happened, I had a lot of context about the history of racism in our country. And immediately, I recognized there was going to be a shift in our society. And there was going to be a focus on our community, the Muslim community in the United States, and there was going to be an enormous amount of backlash. All of a sudden, it became, we are the enemy. What I saw with a lot of white folks was Muslim people in this society went from being completely unknown to, I have a very specific idea about who you are. Muslim people are overwhelmingly viewed to be people of color. And so as a result, there's a racial dynamic there. And also I think it's been interesting because I think that there's a concerted effort to make us foreign and the other.
Frank Rich, who again is a fairly liberal columnist and wrote a piece, I think it was in the New York Times right after or right before the election, where he said that, you know, basically racism is not a problem anymore because when white folks get to know black folks, well, their biases and their fears subside. Now, number one, I'm not sure that's true. But secondly, even if it were true, the truth is, given the history of racism, spatial segregation, residential isolation, the fact that 85% of white folks live in communities with virtually no people of color around, even if he were right, it wouldn't matter because most white folks won't get that opportunity to actually form close, intimate friendships or connections with people of color. And unfortunately, if it isn't happening, the only way we get to know folks of color is via media. So maybe we see Barack Obama on television coming into our living rooms every night, and over an 18-month to two-year period, we're able to say, yeah, you know, I sort of like that guy. He seems really capable and really bright. Maybe I wasn't sure at first, but given 2 years, he was able to overcome, you know, maybe my first impression. But the only other folks we're seeing in the media are either folks who are sort of superstars on the one hand, or criminals on the other hand. Those are the black folks we typically see on TV. They're either like mega millionaire athletes or entertainers, or they're the folks doing the perp walk on the 6 o'clock news that the cops have just gone arrested and haven't even let them put a shirt on before cuffing them and bringing them out in front of the cameras. If the only people you see regularly are superstar millionaires and thugs, for the average person, they can't relate to either of those, right? The average person of color can't, and the average white person can't either. The superstar, you're likely to envy their position, and the thug, you're afraid of. And envy and fear are not particularly good human emotions upon which to base some personal connections or intimate relationships. So I think that's what we're dealing with. You know, Barack Obama or Bill Cosby or Oprah Winfrey or a handful of people of color, we're able to get to know them, or at least we think we know them, via media. But for average everyday white folks and for average everyday black and brown folks, the ability to really get to know each other and overcome those implicit biases is a lot more rare.
My very first class at the university was this sociology And somehow I ended up in this sociology class where there were was a small class. It was about maybe 150 students. And most classes were at least 400 or 500 students. And the professor was a WASP. And really, grew up in the summer, I really didn't know what a WASP was, you know? And so the professor, the first day of class, he said, how many WASPs were in the classroom? And so I was looking around, because I was looking for this, like, WASP, this thing, people. And so as I was looking around, I saw people raising their hands. And finally, I raised my hand. But I was raising my hand to ask a question. And the professor knew I wasn't a WASP. So he looked at me, he said, how may I help you? And then he said, is it you? And I said, yes, what is a WASP? And so he looked at me with such disdain and such venom. He said, what? Anglo-Saxon Protestant, of course. And then everybody in the class laughed. And when they all laughed, I was just like, you know, I felt horrible. I sank down in my seat, and that's when I realized that to speak was not the right thing to do.
That interpersonal level is when we're making decisions about how we're actually going to treat other people and what we're going to make possible or not possible for them. That's when, as a teacher, for example, if you have a young Black kid who's having a hard time settling down, you're making decisions based on your beliefs about whether that kid needs a little bit more attention, or that kid needs to be sent to special education, or that kid needs to be expelled from the school because he can't act right.
Yeah.
At the institutional level, we see racism play out in both the written rules and the unwritten rules of that institution.
I went to Lionel Wilson College Preparatory Academy, first high school building opened in 40 years. Funded by many donations, it was clearly not no ghetto school. Though they placed in the middle of Brandy Park, East Oakland on 105th, for those who missing this, that would be the ghetto. So those who ran it were potentially shocked and appalled at the dead and tagging appearing in the halls, the black signs scraped in the walls, and the rocks tossed so frequently through windows. What did they expect? Should have known you can't take the ghetto out of kids even if you place them in a clean-cut environment, because they will do anything to remove dissonance. So when you're using crack vials lining your walkways and everything you own is a step past shitty, you really ain't trying to see nothing pretty.
White boy who walks in the room and is animated and moving around and maybe even a little cheeky is smart. And isn't he smart? Isn't he cheeky? He's almost looked at as, well, boys will be boy. A child of a boy of color, especially an African-American boy, who walks in the room exhibiting the same behavior, walks in and says, I might need to keep an eye on him. We are afraid of these young boys. And I'm talking young boys, 4 years old and above. And that instead of the teacher looking at him or herself and saying, what is going on with me, that this same behavior creates fear in me instead of admiration, we pathologize the boy of color.
Jump shot.
No, look, I want to get over there.
Dance.
No, listen, I need to get over there.
Crack.
No, I'm sorry, look, I just want to get over there.
Rap.
No, I need to get over there.
Hey, man. Hey, jump shot.
There was no place for us in school. I would argue that the greatest waste of time in my life was the 4 years I spent in high school. And this is coming from an educator. That there was, from the food we were fed to the only way we were really accepted in school, you know, that black boys are the mascots of any high school that they're in where I grew up. I don't know about other places. I've seen it in other places, though. I see it now at universities, where like the black dudes are, you know, they're the provocative part of your experience in high school or college or in the workplace, you know. And for me, it didn't speak to me. race always deals with boxes, right? And I think when we are, so let's say you grow up in a suburb, you know, or you grow up in an affluent area in a city that has an affluent area and a ghetto, but you're black, a black boy. And you get to school and there's a box for you. And that box says you rap, you're an athlete, you're slightly to highly misbehaved. You're not involved or into your education that much. You sell and or use drugs. That's the box that you're accepted in. And in order to play ball, no pun intended, that's how you interact with yourself, your own identity, and this is how you're cool. But you feel like the box that it traps you in is you feel like to be healthier, to be in a more sound mind state, to think and know and come from a place of foundation in your life is something that you have to be ashamed of and you have to denounce. Can drive you crazy.
Boy is born. He is beautiful, as everyone is. He is brown, like his parents. He is loved. He grows. One day coming from school, cops stop boy. Cops do not love boy. Tell boy so. Call him stupid. Bad, stupid, ugly, brown, black, brown, ugly. Call him stupid, bad, ugly. TV tells boy what cops say, true. Teachers show boy they believe what cops say, true. News say, tubes say, people say, seem like even steeples say, what cops say, true. Boy blue.
You know, when I get the occasion, and I don't get it very often, to sit down and do trainings or workshops with law enforcement officers, one of the things that I do, usually in the first 5 minutes, is to ask them, you know, what's the very first thing you think when you see a young black or Latino male driving a nice car in your community? And almost invariably, and with very few exceptions, including among the officers of color, they will respond, probably a drug dealer. I will then ask them, next question, when you see a young white male, same age, driving the same kind of car in your community, what is the first thing you think? And almost every time, without exception, including among the officers of color, they will say, spoiled little rich kid, daddy probably bought him a car. Now, on the one level, you know, we've been together for 5 minutes, me and these cops, we got a 2-hour workshop, 3-hour workshop coming, and they've already outed themselves fundamentally as racist in the sense that they've acknowledged their perception, which is solely based on skin color, is one that is negative toward, in this case, black or brown kids. How is that gonna manifest? Well, logic tells you that if you're a police officer who has that reaction, you may not like the spoiled little rich kid either. In fact, you probably don't. But you're not going to hassle him because you're afraid his daddy might have some power. On the other hand, if you think the black or brown kid is a dealer, you're going to stop him. You're going to search him. You're probably not going to find anything, according to the data. But now you're going to have his name in the system. You're going to be on the lookout for his car. You're able to, in effect, tag him as a possible wrongdoer. And then that's how these folks get caught up, young black and brown men in particular, in the system being harassed over and over and over again, while the white folks, according to the data, are the ones more likely to have drugs in their car, more likely to bring drugs through airports, the ones who are the least suspected are the ones who are actually most likely to be guilty. So you have the combination of personal bias and the reality then of systemic mistreatment, and then the irony of it all is it actually leads you astray and doesn't allow you to do your job effectively. If you're a cop, thinks the black or brown kid's got drugs and the white kid has drugs, you're not even doing your job well. So at some level, you know, these personal biases not only affect systemic behavior, but they actually have profound larger social consequences in that our criminal justice resources are really deployed in the completely wrong area.
So a good example is our current foreclosure crisis and the housing crisis. What happened there is that 30, 40 years ago, you had banks making very explicit racial decisions not to loan to people of color, and particularly not to loan to people who are trying to integrate neighborhoods. That kind of explicit racism was outlawed by the Community Reinvestment Act and by some other civil rights laws. But what came up in their place is a whole range of new financial institutions, and those folks began to make what are now known as subprime loans. And they went to the communities that had very little access to traditional mortgages. Their behavior, their lending practices, created a racist impact. It created a tremendous loss of wealth and a huge foreclosure crisis in communities of color. But we couldn't address it because they weren't saying explicitly, we're targeting these people because of their race. So we need to have a sense of racism as it works through our rules and regulations, or our lack of rules and regulations, even if no one is intentionally trying to be racist.
There is a sort of seductive myth and undercurrent of this whole idea of post-raciality that, like, the answer is everyone should have, you know, relationships across race and then everything's gonna go away. Particularly in the Bay, you know, you get that. You see a lot of couples who are raced differently. Like, you go down the lakeshore and lots of beautiful babies everywhere. And so some people would point to that as like, hey, mountaintop, here we are. And I think that so often we talk about the interpersonal when it comes to race, when we need to be talking about the structural also.
In all the social justice work I've done, as I look at who was making the decision about that transportation project, that job training program, very rarely do the people who are making the decisions come from the communities that those decisions are going to impact. So they are not representative of those communities, and more often than not, they are also not even responsive to those communities. I really became so focused on the different access to resources and opportunities that different people have and how that influences what happens generation after generation after generation. What makes places the places that they are? Who decided that? And where's the money going?
At the structural level, you're understanding the relationship between those different kinds of institutions. So you understand that housing segregation, for example, affects school financing. And so housing segregation is going to generate segregation in schools, and it's going to generate uneven education for kids of color. And so if you only try to intervene in education with the education institutions, you're only going to make limited progress, because we know that the housing institutions also affect what happens in schools.
I like the idea of living in a multiracial community so that my children can get to know lots of different people and feel comfortable in all these different cultures and be able to go out into the world comfortable with that. But on the other hand, I'm also challenged because I really need my child to have a really good education. And so in order to have a good education, they need to live in a neighborhood where they can go to a good school. And a good school is determined by how much tax that school is able to collect. And I have to make choices about that. So then say I make the decision to buy a house in a good neighborhood so my child has a good education. Chances are that neighborhood is less racially diverse. Then that means that my child will not have the same kinds of interracial experiences growing up that I had living in a city where my parents had fewer choices that were related to my father's immigration status, or not status, but the fact that he was an immigrant. and that it was harder for him to find good work, which limited where we could live. I may value racial diversity, but given that wealth and access to schooling is so closely linked to home ownership in this society, I don't have to be racist in the traditional sense of the word of not liking somebody who's not like myself to actually be carrying on that tradition.
Structural racism, you know, the first part of it is that you're looking multiple institutions and you're looking at the culture, the morals, the aspirations, the ideas, the language, the images, all of those things that comprise a culture. But the other parts are that you're paying very serious attention to history, because that's the way structural racism works, that history matters.
So I'm 21, right? And I find out that there's this distant relative of mine who once upon a time was the governor of Mississippi, J.P. Coleman. He was the governor between 1956 and 1960. Mind you, he was elected into office 4 months after Brown II. And one of the first things he did was set up the State Sovereignty Commission and sort of be in cahoots with the Citizens Council and try to use the law to preserve Mississippi's way of life, to subvert Brown through a-racial legalistic means. In the archives, I was reading this letter that to me echoed of a sort of Ward Connolly colorblind approach to the law as a way to ensure that racialized hierarchies of power continue and are upheld. And the letter was basically one of, you know, in 1956 Mississippi, looking to remove the language of race from the law so as to maintain segregated schools. In my opinion, it was, you know, incredibly insidious, but also what made it so that by the end of his term, there were still separate schools.
The reality is, if you're not part of the power structure, you're not one of the ones making the decision, I think you're hyper aware of what's happening. You're hyper aware of the decisions that are being made and how they impact you. And for the folks who are in positions of power, they don't need to think about it. They don't need to critique it. It works for them.
As long as we are being taught that where you end up is about your effort, then the fact of inequality between groups of people is going to come to be seen as natural evidence of some people's superiority and other people's inferiority. Because if you don't educate folks because you figure it's just wasting money, if you don't provide equal job opportunity or equal housing opportunity, and you don't really care if there's disproportionate incarceration because you think, quote unquote, those folks are all bad anyway, then you create this sort of snowball effect where the uneducated and those who can't find housing and those who can't find jobs will almost invariably have to find some way to survive, and that will involve, in some cases, criminal activity, which then will land them in jail. When they get out of jail, 60% of employers say they won't hire anyone who they know to be an ex-con, right? So ultimately, we sort of keep this system in place by a combination of actual practices in the job market, the school system, et cetera, but also the underlying ideological glue of the society.
The system of inequity is embedded in history, culture, and identity. It has internal components and external components. These components are moved or influenced by power and economics. The internal components consist of bias, privilege, and internalized racism. The external components play out in relationships which are interpersonal, institutional, and structural. All of these layers are happening simultaneously, and they are churning out inequities.
We'll spend just about 2 minutes with feeling word responses, if you don't mind. I'll track some of them on the screen. If I think it's correct, I did. Write anything up, I do not. So, paying attention to that, what should I write on this board that captures any of the range of feeling you have, just feeling words, in response to watching all these people speak?
and all these chapters of the story, all the different parts of the model. Again, I have lots of these. Use as many as I needed. Discouraged. Gone.
Overwhelmed. Complex.
Your feelings are complex?
Well, that the issue is so, not so simple.
How does that make you feel?
Overwhelmed.
Yeah.
Frustrated.
Like writing on this board. Good grief.
Embarrassed.
Really? At one in particular, do you mind? I'm embarrassed about?
Not understanding the depth.
Okay.
Of my, what I don't know.
Okay. Any other embarrassments you could name in the room? I'm embarrassed at what I didn't know.
Reminding moments that I realized my own racial bias.
Okay. And is that a kind of embarrassment you're naming?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, are you just adjusting the shape?
Disheartened.
Oh.
A little hopeful.
Is that you, Em?
Yeah.
You want to say a word about hopeful?
Just the one example she gave of somebody being able to use their privilege to turn around a situation. It's like, I could be that brave.
Mm-hmm. That's true. We could do the interpersonal work. I agree with the discouragement when I think about, and I just turned my mic on if you're wondering why I sound different. I didn't just like develop new vocal cords. That I'm thinking about all the places where I felt like there was agency offered me in this film. It was interpersonal agency. Here's something you can do in this moment. But I didn't think they really touched on the structural stuff, right? You get to that point and I still feel kind of stuck. But the hopeful part, I agree with you around, yeah, why wouldn't I do that? Why wouldn't I just, like, right away get in there? It took me a minute. You heard the anecdote, I think. Was that last week I talked about the Pride Parade and the intervention? I did a bystander intervention at my first Pride Parade march about a month ago in Portland. There was a guy marching with my church who was in a clerical collar, and there was a guy who kept hassling him. Come by with a cigarette and was just kind of, you know, I don't like the collar. What are you doing the collar in this kind of thing? And bystander intervention, if you're doing it right, you don't approach the perpetrator, you approach the victim as though you know them and you engage them in conversation. But it took me a good 2 minutes of watching this before I realized, oh, I'm part of the system that's letting this happen. Honey, I'm going to go do an intervention. And so I just walked between them and I said, would you like to be in a different conversation, with a smile? And he grinned at me and he said, yes, I would. And so we just kind of took off down the street as though we knew each other, just walking real slowly, having a conversation. You in the parade, who are you marching with? Hey, that's my group. You're marching with my group. Cool. And it took like 30 seconds before the guy lost interest and disappeared. Again, interpersonal, but it's not something I could see myself doing. Maybe 2 years ago, I couldn't see myself actually in that position. So that's the hopeful part, is I feel like, what get me over that hump? And could I get over a similar hump and do things that are more collectively oriented, that are going somewhere else? I'd also never marched in a pride parade in 20 years of living in Portland. I ran into one of my students there too, and she immediately burst into tears, and I thought, you idiot. You waited 20 years to be this person in this parade. I could have done it in year one.
Because she was so glad you were there?
Yeah, because I was there and of who I am. And I thought, why did I wait 20 years? Stupid, stupid, stupid. Other words that aren't up here yet, just a few more feeling words, and then we'll get to a little more concrete.
I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. About, do you want to say? Okay, a whole range of things. Yeah, then funny, because you're in both places. One is you're the conduit for this kind of continuing cultural narrative that's pretty limiting, and you're also the first point of contact for people who are meeting this, and you're aware of both things. Like, you're awake to both things, and that really complicates that middle space. How do I navigate that? I'm also a teacher. One or two more? Anything you're feeling that's not up here yet? Ignored?
Ignorant.
I heard another one.
Only because of the depth of the, it's systemic, like, it just goes back so far and so deep and so
Is that it?
Yeah.
I'm happy to write a new one.
No, that's good. That's accurate.
We have our winner. Overwhelmed. So I had two kinds of responses I was asking for from you. One was just general ginger moments from the film as you were watching it. Were there things, there was some vocalization going on while you were watching. There'd be moments where five or six of you would go, And I've seen this several times, and I'm still moved by parts of it in ways that surprise me every time. So let's spend a little bit of time with that. We have a few more minutes left. I'd be interested in that. And then if we don't get to return to the question of whether the right thing to focus on is racial reconciliation or white supremacy, or whether you could do both, is if you're working for one, are you working against the other, right? We may not get to that question, but you are alive beyond this room, and you have lots of people now to talk to. So let's stick with, what were your ginger moments? What stood out to you?
Mine was just the school one. I think about all of that a lot because we work with really young children, mm-hmm. and how those disparities, seeing that little girl grabbed by the police really threw me.
And cuffed, yeah. Part of your job, too, is you're the one that the teachers call when they have trouble, right? So Em's a social worker in elementary school, so she's both educating teachers, educating students, and being a resource in the community. You should hear the teachers stand up for the social workers at budget time because they know they need them. Yeah. Other responses? What stood out to you?
I really appreciated the woman who shared the story about the grocery line. And then... when she came back and she was talking about post-traumatic slave syndrome, I think that's really a helpful piece of this that kind of can easily get missed by me and other white people who might not know where to look for examples of how slavery is still impacting people today.
That's great. Yeah. There's a word mindfulness. It's got so many different definitions. But in intercultural communication, when the word mindfulness is used, what it's referring to is your ability to actually fill your mind with more templates for sense-making than you currently have. So, and it requires, I can't be too anxious, I can't be too uncertain, I have to be a little anxious, a little uncertain, so I'll be doing my most alert behavior in those settings. But that what you're talking about is, can I sort of understand where that denigration of her son might be coming from, aside from the one template I want to put it in, which is I would never talk about my kid that way. Don't be so negative. Let me talk to you about being positive. So that's me taking this new experience and ramming it into a template I already had, instead of being in a space where I can say, what's another way to hear this? Am I missing something? Jim?
Mm-hmm. What happens? What do you see when you have a black teacher? Mm-hmm. They work to the benefit of the black children and just the white ones. Is it like that? Just the opposite?
I don't have direct experience of that, so I couldn't comment. But my guess is it really varies by individual teacher. And whiteness is so pervasive, just like sexism is. I mean, you don't have to be male to participate in a sexist culture. There are lots of ways that we're just reinforcing the code, whether we know we are or not. Maybe I'm just teaching the curriculum I've been offered. And in the process of doing that, my white experience gets more centered in a way that I wouldn't maybe choose for myself, but I'm also constrained from doing much else with that. It's a logical question to think, what about people who have a position of power but aren't centered in all these identity categories? How often and in what ways do people leverage that experience to do something else? I have the converse at my university. I'm a really odd person to be teaching communication across barriers, right? We talk about ableism, ageism, heterosexism, racism, classism, sexism, duh. And I'm centered in all of them. Like when we did the quiz yesterday, I'm 56. I get the top score and everything. So my job is to sort of really do the mindful thing and say, okay. It's like I'm a submarine. You know, I'm the stealthy person. Students sign up for the class and think, oh, I'm going to get this stuff and it's going to be totally safe. It is not going to be totally safe. But that's sort of the work of somebody who's in my position. It can be pretty tough. Yeah.
About sort of the politics of it. One thing, and it's so obvious, but it just strikes me. You know, she said when women got the vote, men had to give it to them. Mm-hmm. You know, women could protest, women could speak up, but they couldn't do anything about it. The people who had the power had to change it.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, you know, when you joke about being the person who has 56, I mean, in the end, we have that power, and we're.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The Peggy McIntosh you saw talking a couple times, she's the one who developed the white knapsack. She likes to talk about a couple different kinds of privilege. But her favorite metaphor for privilege is to think of it like a bank account and to say, where do you want to spend it? That you have credit. And there are things you can spend it on that other people will never have that much credit. And even though they'd love to spend it in certain ways, oftentimes I'm in a great position to spend it. But I don't think to do it. I don't see it. I don't notice the opportunities, or if I do notice, I'm not entirely sure how to engage the opportunity interpersonally, much less institutionally or societally, that those moments go past me. And I'm being told through my whole education, don't worry about those things, right? So it's this whole journey you kind of have to take on to even figure out how to get involved. And then you need the multiple tries of getting involved in anything that gets you going.
So I was thinking about at the beginning, you know, before the news, well, even, yeah, you were showing just the slides about...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, Hackett.
Yeah, and I kept on finding myself thinking, wait, I would probably try to have a conversation like that. The conversation she was saying, don't try to have a conversation. Like, I just kept on thinking, well, so what can I do? What some things are obvious like that checkout line situation, but, and just trying to understand better, or I guess I'm just like aware of how unaware, even though I thought I was kind of aware, I really am. And then, but what to do about it, like my instinctual steps that I think I would take, and I'm just learning, oh, no, not supposed to do that. Mm-hmm. So then I have the question mark of, so what should I do?
Well, can we go to the grocery store situation for a second? And I just want to ask the room, do you think that encounter was mostly about dealing with white supremacy? Or mostly about dealing with racial reconciliation? What do you think was the primary driver of that interaction? What are your thoughts? You want to start, Chris?
I think it was mostly about white supremacy. I say that because the initial thing she was dealing with, the white-looking sister-in-law, was the woman acting like white supremacists.
Mm-hmm. Calling her out?
And it ended up being about reconciliation. That ended up happening, sort of. But I don't think that's how it started.
Okay. Other opinions in the room? What do you think?
I thought it involved racial recognition.
Racial recognition,
yeah.
Or reconciliation?
Reconciliation.
Okay.
You know,
how come?
Black bad. You know, they see that in Washington as well. We've got a couple black people when they're shoplifted or their checks are bouncing. So, you know, not officially, but unofficially, you should check them real well.
Okay. So it was an interaction designed to make less of that happen, less racially based grocery store difficulties happen.
I mean, we're seeing that up in the metro, including the Twin Cities, a lot of Minneapolis especially, where the more tension there is, the more outbreaks there is.
Mm-hmm.
12 and 15-year-old kids are getting thrown on the ground because someone called police that there might be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the police come and they chuck them on the ground and cuff them until they get the story straight.
Mm-hmm.
By then, there's about 85 cell phones on it,
which is good.
So it's
there was something happened just a couple days ago that police got called because an African-American man set a hard screen in a basketball game. And so the cops came and stopped the basketball game and pulled the guy aside for setting a hard screen, which means he just blocked another player so that his teammate could get to the basket with the ball. It's a part of basketball playing.
So why?
So somebody called. Yeah, well, it was a black kid. Yeah, we got a call on that. So you're thinking about situations like that. I mean, the analogy you brought up, Chris, is to say, I don't think it started out that way, but its effect might be some racial reconciliation by calling out the white supremacy. I draw an analogy to how we teach conflict in the communication discipline is we rarely teach conflict resolution. We don't walk through that door. We walk through the conflict management door. Because not every conflict is resolvable. You might have something going on with me, and we may never get to the bottom of it. But if I set out and say, we are going to get to the bottom of this, and we don't, sometimes we're worse off than we started. But if we walk into it and say, you know, let's build something around this. Let's make sense of this. Bless you. Let's make sense of this. Often by setting out to manage it, it gets resolved. But very seldom is the opposite true, that you set out to resolve it and it just winds up neatly managed. So it often depends on, you know, what approach you take. What am I actually taking on about the situation? And you might achieve more than one aim. As you listen to the woman's argument as we started this thing, before I showed the film, what were your thoughts about whether you could pursue one or the other? Did it feel like I had to make a choice? That if I'm pursuing one, I can't pursue the other. If I pursue one of them, it's going to always diminish the other one, my ability to do the other. Any thoughts about that? Do they feel like incompatible goals? I'm either trying to raise consciousness about white supremacy and do something about that system, or I'm working toward racial reconciliation at all these different levels, interpersonal, organizational, institutional. What do you think?
Well, racial reconciliation to me sounds like right off the bat that it accepts white supremacy. They need to reconcile to us. They're the ones that are wrong. Mm-hmm. If they would fix themselves, we'd all be happy to get along. Mm-hmm.
And they had a really specific role in these encounters, like, you know, please be there for me when I finally wake up and hold my hand, make it okay for me. And that doesn't do anything about the system. It just, okay, so if I go through the racial reconciliation door, some other things are just not part of the conversation, in your view.
I can see it as a hazard.
A hazard, okay.
You need to be aware of that.
Okay. So I could still go through the door.
If you realize that you've got a lot to give up, that there's a lot of supremacy, there's a lot on your shoulders.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. The stuff that happened with TV torches. And, I mean, I find myself, I feel like we got a name of that because it is what it is. But it's, I worry that people would push back against it just because of its name. Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things she talked about at the very beginning was to say, why are you using these words? It's so hard to get people even to think about something like privilege. There's a word for that, by the way, white fragility, right? That we just, and that itself gets studied, especially by sociologists who are trying to make sense of why is it we're so reluctant to even talk about this as though we were talking about our bank account or the oil in the engine. You know, why won't we do it? Well, there are a lot of forces arrayed trying to keep us out of that conversation, and it's super easy to go along with those voices and just continue as things are. It's a difficult, just in terms of how it gets labeled, that sort of sets a certain game for people. Oh, you're one of those people. You're doing touchy-feely work. Or what are the other words that we, what did she talk about yesterday? The purple polka-dotted people? You know, you're one of those people. So they're already kind of putting you in the irrelevant box.
Well, you know, you just made a point there about that. And I just wonder how many of us are playing that hide-and-seek game with this topic by, you know, how many of us live in predominantly white neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. You know, we hide in our white neighborhoods, and during the day we go out and seek either justice or a feel-good thing. Mm-hmm. But then we run back and hide in our white neighborhoods. Mm-hmm.
Sure. My folks are near a white neighborhood in Mesa. There are several of these where they are exempted from paying taxes that support schools because we're all retired people. We don't have kids anymore. So what do we care about? You know, we shouldn't have to do that anymore. We don't care what sort of society we live in or, you know, who we grew up with. Give us our money. So that's a kind of a way that segregation actually plays into the wider system. Should we do a show of hands? How many of you live in a community you would say is segregated by race? Whether by choice or not, you just find yourself there. I know I do. How many feel like you are in a really integrated, racially integrated community? How many aren't sure? Raise your hands if you're not sure. This is like a trick question, right? To say, raise your hand if you're not sure.
Well, yeah, I would say, depends on, I mean, I live in a small town. Mm-hmm. I would say the state is segregated. Rural areas are predominantly white, and urban areas then have segregated neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So I guess by virtue of living in a small town, I think that, you know, mm-hmm. unless I want to commute from 200 miles away.
Yeah. I grew up with one African-American guy in my high school, Donald McCracken, and he never got to be anything but black. Like every interaction he was in, it's like, hey, the black guy's here. So I'll say more about that in a second.
So we moved to Alexandria, Virginia, and when I shot, sometimes I'm the only white person.
Oh, that's right.
Store. And we live in a very diverse area there, but I don't have any black friends. Mm-hmm. I don't have any Somali friends. I don't
yet
have any Northern African friend, which is, I mean, you can eat every kind of food you can around.
Sure. There.
And I had a friend of mine confront, she said, are you kidding me? You don't have? I said, well, I came from like Woodinville, Washington a couple years ago, and there were no, and I didn't seek any out. Anyway, and so she was just like, what? Anyway, I felt a little, so even though I shop and we go to restaurants and we go to the area, and it's, I don't rush back into my neighborhood, but, you know, I'm back in the house.
Right, so. But being served by people who are different than us is different than actually engaging them as equals. I like Tim Wise's comment about, what was it, fear or envy? Aren't great bases for intimate, you know, ongoing relationships. They are. I'm worried about time. I want to say this and then to you.
Just real quick, I have a friend who's a black man and a white woman.
Mm-hmm.
Friends, I live down in Air Park in Arizona. And they're from Washington State. And I says, well, gee, you should stop in and visit me sometime, you know. And because they are my friends. And they says, oh, we can't do that because that my town is such a white supremacist town. And I just, I was appalled. And I've asked a few people and they said, they are not aware of it. But on the other hand,
they're not living in brown skin.
Yes, I don't know.
So these are beautiful segues to Friday's session. Friday's session is about how do you get started interpersonally? So I have this hope. I'd love to connect with people who are different than me. I'd love to make it, you know, how do I make a safe way for this person to like feel like, yeah, you'd be absolutely safe coming to my home. How do I do that? How should I even create that moment and get started with that sort of thing? And could you bring some friends along? You know, what sort of thing do I want to have? Chuck, the director, was talking last night about an activist who'd been in the village 3 weeks ago or so, who was saying, you know what, you just need to come to a barbecue at our house in Seattle. Just come for the weekend, you and Peg. And we'll invite everybody over, and we'll have you here. In effect, they'd be the minority, you know, at that setting, happily, and really enjoy what there is to be learned in that moment. So Friday is all about exploring some resources that are about, so how do you actually then interpersonally? That's the level, that's my cop-out, that's my bias, that's my expertise, most importantly. What can we do interpersonally that helps get beyond this moment? These pieces here are for reading between now and then, if you'd like to, you don't have to. But the one by Wendell Berry, just some quotes from The Hidden Wound, if you like the humanities side of things. Rebecca Solnit's also on the humanities side of things. She's talking about more recent events and talking a little more politically. So I have enough of these. There's enough for everybody here, so if you feel like taking those. These are from the session yesterday. If you missed any of those, they're here too. So thank you very much. I'm really glad you were here.